This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. You know, most musicians would consider it an honor and be just fine to be inducted into the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame once. To be inducted twice is quite a rarity. Graham Nash achieved that honor for his work with the Hollies and also, of course, Crosby, Stills, and Nash. The singer-songwriter-musician is responsible for music that helped define a generation and still lives on as part of the American musicscape. Last year, Graham Nash released Over the Years, a double CD featuring the songs Our House and other hits he is well known for. In 2016, he recorded his first studio album in 14 years, This Path Tonight. It's got 10 original songs. Graham Nash has been on a North Carolina tour with a recent stop in North Carolina and joins us now. Graham Nash, what a pleasure. Welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you, Frank. How are you doing today?
I'm doing very well. Very kind of you to ask. How are you doing? You're on tour, and I ask this of great musicians like yourself who have had marvelous careers and entertained us for so long. Why do it? Do you still like being on the road?
I wouldn't be here if I didn't want to be. I'm lucky enough to be able to do what I want with my life. An incredibly lucky thing. I realize that, and I'm forever grateful to the great spirit of the universe that I'm still here and still creating and still making people happy. One of the things that I love is when I come to the end of a show and I see the people leaving, smiling, talking to themselves, telling each other what a good time they had, that's when I know I've done my job.
People would be doing that if you did the songs that you wrote back then that helped establish your career. You're still writing. You're still creating new songs. What motivates you and what keeps you fresh? Where do you find that creative energy these days?
Just from being alive. I've always been an incredibly curious person. I wrote my autobiography a couple of years ago called Wild Tales. I was doing a book signing in Manchester, which is in the north of England, which is basically where I come from. And this kid came up to me and he gave me an 8x10 manila envelope. And I said, "Why, thank you." He gave, "No," he says, you need this." I said, "Really?" He said, "Yeah, but don't open it until you get back to the hotel." So I got back to the hotel and I opened this envelope and in it was my school report card from when I was 11. And the first thing that the teacher said was, "This boy wants to know everything." I have no idea how he got my school report card.
Yeah.
An interesting moment.
Obviously, you haven't learned everything. What are some of the great surprises? What's new for you? What's something that you've discovered, you know, very recently that surprised you?
That there really is a difference between people that promote violence and chaos and people that promote peace and love. There's a big difference. And part of this administration, you know, of course, is concentrated on dividing us. On keeping us separate, on us not liking people that aren't the same religion as us or the same color as us, and it's becoming increasingly clearer to me that there is a very, very large dividing line dividing the American people right now, and I wish it wasn't so.
We talked about, if we think about the music in those days, back when Crosby, Stills, Nash, Crosby, Stills, Nash and Young were around and entertaining us all, we associated that music with the kind of cultural artifacts that were bringing people together. But I want to talk to you about more deeply, because you talked about your autobiography. You're very honest about all the other things that went on, the addictions to drugs, to women, to the attention. To what extent were we all, I'm a member of that generation, a little bit fooled? This was a commercial. You wrote great songs. They're terrific songs. But how much of that really was political, and how much of that was just a very important part and a very useful part of a commercial enterprise?
Well, you know, the truth is that I'd sold millions of records before I ever met David and Steven. so our lives were slightly different, you know. I'm an incredibly simple man. I come from the north of England, from a very poor family, and I found this talent when I was 13 years old to make music, and my mother and father encouraged me to do that rather than, you know, forcing me to get a real job. And I'll be forever grateful to them. And here I am trying the best I can with what gifts I have been given. And once again, I tell you, I'm incredibly grateful. I feel like I'm an incredibly lucky man. I mean, I'm 77 years old now.
Well, you talked about selling millions of records before meeting David Crosby and Stephen Stills. That was because you were with a band called The Hollies, which was an incredibly successful band, more successful than those two in that particular moment when you met. Why did you leave The Hollies?
I had heard that sound. When David and Stephen and I first sang together in Joni's living room.
Joni Mitchell.
In 1967, 68. I'm a musician, you know, and the Hollies and the Springfield and the Byrds were pretty decent harmony bands. But when David and Stephen and I first sang together, it was completely shocking to us, A, how beautiful it sounded when we made our three voices sound like one voice, and B, you know, look at the songs that we had to record. They were beautiful songs, profound songs to make you think about different things. And I had heard that sound. And my soul said, I have to follow that sound. I'm a musician. I found something incredible. I knew at that moment I had to leave, and go back to England and leave my band, the Hollies, and leave my equipment and leave my friends and come to America and start a brand new life. And I thought it was incredibly courageous, but it was the only thing that my heart said to do.
It is a sound that I am told, and I've heard you say, that you heard when you were singing this song before it was ever recorded.
In the long run, it will make you cry, make you crazy, oh, before your time. And the difference between me and you, I won't argue right or wrong, but I have time to cry.
You Don't Have to Cry, Crosby, Stills, and Nash from their debut self-titled album in 1969. Graham Nash is with us. And is this right? You were sitting around and that song came up? Was that the one?
That's the one. We were having dinner at Joni's house. And David said, hey, Stephen, play Willie, that song that we've just been doing. And what happened is that, you know, David had been throwing out the Byrds and the Springfield were breaking up. And so David and Stephen were trying to get some, you know, kind of like an Everly Brother thing, you know, a duo kind of thing together. And they'd been practicing this one particular song. And David said to Stephen, play Willie, the song, come on. And so they played this song, You Don't Have to Cry, which he just played. And they got to the end of it, and I said, wow, that's an incredibly beautiful song, Stephen. That's fabulous. Do me a favor, sing it again. And they looked at each other, and they shrugged, and they sang it again. And they got to the end of the second performance, and I said, okay, I'm this crazy Englishman, but do me a favor, sing it one more time. In the two times that they had performed it, I learned the song, I learned the lyrics, I learned how David was standing, I learned how Stephen's body language was when he ended a line. I'm good at what I do. I've been doing this a long time. And so we sang it the third time, and after 40 seconds, maybe 45 seconds, we had to stop and start laughing. It was ridiculously clear what we had to do with the rest of our lives. and that's what happened.
So you've said that the sound that we associate with that band, that unique sound, was developed, as you said, in 40 seconds.
Yes.
Wow. Talk about that. You know, you mentioned the Everly Brothers. You actually recorded with them, and you had some pretty good side people on the, on that record, right?
Yeah. The Hollies were doing the London Palladium, which was like in kind of an Ed Sullivan show on a Sunday evening, a very popular television show. And Pete Seeger was the headliner, and the Hollies were supporting him. And we had a sound check around 4:30, and the phone rang backstage. Our tour manager, Rod Shields, picked up the phone and goes, he's right here. Yeah, hold on one second. And he hands me the phone, and I go, who is he? He said, it's Phil Everly. I said, come on, don't screw with me like that. That's not nice. He goes, it's Phil Everly. So I pick up the phone. I go, hello? He goes, hey, Graham, it's Phil. I said, well, great, Phil. How are you doing? Why are you calling me in England right now? He said, well, I'm here with Don, and we're in England to do a record called Two Yanks in England. And do the Hollies have any songs that they haven't recorded yet? And, you know, we were a young band, and we had a lot of songs. So we went down to the hotel where they were staying, the Ritz Hotel in London, and we went into their room, and we played them these songs, and they chose, I think, five or six of them. And they said they were going to start recording, and could we help them? And I said, yeah, sure. When are you going to record? He said, tomorrow morning. So the very next day, there we were in the studio helping the Everly Brothers make a record. And as you mentioned, there were a certain session men in there. One particular was a great piano player that worked for Dick James, who was a publisher, named Reggie Dwight, who obviously became Elton John, and Jimmy Page and John Paul Jones.
Wow. Led Zeppelin. Wow.
And me and Alan singing with the Everly Brothers, yes.
Pretty cool. You mentioned Dick Jones. You've got a story about actually leaving the Hollies. That's a pretty incredible story in the record industry, even then, but today it's improbable.
Yes. Dick James, actually.
Dick James, I'm sorry, yeah.
What was the man's name? Yeah. Well, he made a mistake. Here's what happened. We signed, when we first started going to London to make records, we signed with a publishing company, Dick James's company. And he said to me, you know, if in years to come, you know, anything's going on that you don't like, you know, just come to me, we'll figure it out. And I said, all right, great. So 6 or 7 years later, after I've heard that sound that David and Stephen and I created vocally, I went to Dick and I said, you know, I'm leaving the Hollies. I'm leaving England. I'm going to live in America, and I'm going to make some music with these two other guys. And he told me years ago that if I was ever in any kind of trouble, that to come to you. And he said, yeah, okay, well, all right, well, here's what we do about this. And he picked up his phone, and he talked to his secretary. He said, yeah, bring Mr. Nash's contract in. So we waited about 5 minutes, and a knock on the door, and the secretary brought in the papers, and he looked at me, and he held the papers before my eyes, and he says, this is what we'll do about this. And he tore them up, and he said, you're free.
And
go
at that,
to America, have a great time.
And at that time, it was a 50-50 split, right, with songwriters and the publisher. Wow.
It was a 50-50 split. And he also published The Beatles, and he also published Elton John. I mean, this was but he was a mensch. I mean, you know, he told me I could come to him if I was ever in trouble and we'd figure it out, and he figured it out. And he set me free. And that was millions of dollars.
Yeah. Great stuff. Great story. I've got to get you to tell us one more story, and that is the story about A Bet, a song that was written on a bet. Tell us about that.
I was in Maui one day in the Hawaiian Islands. I was on vacation there. And I had a couple of hours to kill before I had to catch a plane back to Los Angeles, where David and Stephen and I were recording. I was at the home of a friend of mine, and even though he was a friend of mine, he had no respect for me. You know, I mean, he was jokingly, of course. And as I got up to leave, he said, "Hey, I'll bet you $500 you can't write a song just before you go." I said, "What?" He said, "I'll bet you $500 you can't write a song just before you go, just before you leave." I said, "Really? $500? Wow." I still have his $500 I wrote. He gave me the title for the song in the question. I wrote, just the song before I go, right there.
We will play that song on the way out as we say goodbye and thank you so much to Graham Nash. Graham Nash, what a pleasure. Thanks for talking with us.
Frank, it's been a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Singer, songwriter, musician, and two-time Rock and Roll Hall of Fame inductee, Graham Nash. Graham Nash's current release is a best-of double CD called Over the Years, and you can find out more about the show at our website, stateofthings.org, a program produced by Anita Rao, Laura Pelliser, Dana Terry, Amanda Magnus, and Jennifer Brookland. Robin Copley is the technical director. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stacio, and here's a song just before I go.
Just a song before I go. Traveling twice the speed of sound, it's easy to get burned. When the shows were over, we had to get back home. When we opened up the door, I had to be she helped me with my suitcase. She stands before my eyes, driving me to the airport and to the friendly skies. Going through security, I held her for too long.